So, John, thank you for joining me today.
Sure thing, Brian. Thank you for inviting me.
I think you know where this is going to start. It's going to start at the beginning, but I'm going to put a little twist on the question, which was, do you think you seriously fell in love with statistics first or with baseball?
Well, I would have to say it's baseball first because, I distinctly remember going to games with my dad on the south side of Chicago. I would get my baseball equipment every year by going to the bat day doubleheader. I'd have my bat for that summer, and playing baseball I was passionate about. We played softball, 16-inch Chicago softball, but my favorite game was a game called fast pitching, we called it, and it was simply drawing a chalk line on the school wall. And with the outline of the strike zone, and it was just two guys, one guy pitching to the other, trying to throw a ball as hard as he could to strike out the guy standing in the batter's box. Mostly it was walks and strikeouts, but occasionally the batter would get a hit. You just put the ball in play, and if it didn't go to the pitcher, it was a hit. And if it went over the fence, it was a homer, but that was pretty rare.
So
So
who were you imagining when you were a kid that you were pitching to, or who were you channeling as a pitcher? Like, who were your favorites?
Well, growing up on the south side of Chicago, it was always White Sox players, so my favorite pitchers were, Joe Horland and Gary Peters and Juan Pizarro and Goose Gossage and Terry Forster, all those guys that they started their careers with the White Sox, often went on to other teams, but the White Sox were known for their pitchers at that time. And then the hitter that always comes to mind when I think about my growing up was Floyd Robinson. He was the right fielder for the White Sox, and he was their only 300 hitter. And there was this weird pattern that went on that when he hit 11 or fewer homers, he hit over 300. And when he hit more than 11 homers, he was under 300. And I kept rooting him for him not to go over 11 because then he could hit 300.
So, like, at what age were you making these connections statistically? Because this is not a typical way a kid would look at st baseball cards and statistics.
Right. So, I mean, it was probably, starting, I would say probably starting at age eight, but it was in my, when I, started going to high school that I really was starting to, for example, I was 13, 1968 White Sox. It was going to be their big year. The 1967 was a four-way pennant race that went down to the last weekend with four teams in the American League. White Sox wound up three games out. They faded in the last few games. But they traded for Louie Aparicio and Tommy Davis, and now they were going to be fantastic for the 1968 season. And so I decided I am going to track all the statistics for the entire year. I made a grid for every player. I had a notebook, and every player had their own page and or set of pages because I'm thinking, all right, I'm going to do 162 games. And I was going to just have a daily log for every player. And I started doing that. And there were days like, oh, the newspaper, I didn't get it today. I got to go next door. I got to get it from my mom's aunt. She'll have it. And I would get her the newspaper. I recorded everything in my own notebooks. And then they went 0-10 to start the season. It was like there was so much hype, and they wound up with what the worst year they had in many, many years. My daily tracking faded after a couple of months because it wasn't quite as exciting, but the tracking of player data, just was a natural thing for me. And I, in school, when I was in high school, we had like a career day, and I said my mission, my goal was to be the statistician for the Chicago White Sox. I'm imagining, working for the White Sox and keeping track of stats. But as it turns out, I have been the statistician in a way my entire career for the White Sox from 1985 to this day, because they have been clients of the two main companies that I've had, Stats and Sports Info Solutions. So My high school dream of being the statistician for the White Sox came true. It took about 10 years of my insurance actuary career to transpire first, which was good and solid, but working in sports has been just a dream come true.
So what do you think was motivating you every day to take that log? And were you trying to find insights from what you recorded? Were you trying to track how good the players were each day?
You know, at that age, I don't think I had any preconceived notions. I just was such a dedicated fan and I love numbers. And I just thought I'll track the numbers. You know, I didn't have anything specific in mind that I'm going to see, like what kind of streaks they have. I think just would come natural to me what I would see after I had the numbers. But, you know, I don't remember. What also started to happen at that time is I started to play a game called Strat-O-Matic Baseball. And it was Strat-O-Matic Baseball that I grew to love so much. And that's where I got more insight about understanding players and analyzing data. I even programmed the entire game on my Apple II computer so that I wouldn't have to always flip cards and look up charts. And so I had the first computer version of Strat-O-Matic Baseball that ever existed.
But that was a couple of years down the line, right?
That was down the line. Yeah, that wasn't in high school. That was actually after college that I wrote that.
I mean, just so that the listener understands, could you kind of explain the statistical framework that's involved with the game?
So the Strat-O-Matic game works is there's a hitter's card and there's a pitcher's card, and it's based on rolling dice. So the hitter's card, if you roll there's three dice. So if you roll a 1, 2, or 3, you're going to be on the hitter's card. And if you roll a 4, 5, or 6, you're on the pitcher's card. And then based on statistical probabilities of the other two dice, you know, if there's a home run on a 7, that's going to be a higher chance of coming up than a home run on an 11, for example. So I actually created computer programs that looked at the statistical probability based on what was happening on each player's card. And I would literally input the cards into a program so that I had, the actual percentages of singles and doubles and triples and walks and everything. So I could determine what is the highest statistical probability and the best cards, you know, to get hits and to, or for pitchers to, you know, get outs. And so it was, you know, my fascination with numbers turned into, well, how do I get an advantage when I play Strat-O-Matic against other people? And so when I would do my draft, I would have the advantage of knowing the actual statistical information on each card. Whereas, you know, Now there are, you know, third parties that do this, but back at that time, no one was doing that. And I would have an advantage over anybody I was drafting with because, you know, they're going to look at the statistics on the card, how the player did, which is a very good, you know, indication of what the player is about. But I had the exact numbers of how often these probabilities of things would happen.
When did you start programming? Was it in college or was it earlier?
So so my degree at Loyola University of Chicago was math and computer science. So, you know, we were using computers back in school then, although it was with card punch. I hate to admit it, but I was punching cards to submit card decks to run the computer programs. And then as soon as that first personal computer came out, the Apple computer, I bought it. And the first thing I started doing, well, after I got all my game playing in, you know, I had to stay up all night a few nights and just play games on the computer. And then I started programming the Strat-O-Matic Baseball game.
Well, what languages did you start programming in and then moving on to basic?
It was basic. Although I did some assembler language, the original Apple computer did not have a keypad. And from working at my insurance company, tabulating columns of numbers on a calculator, I became very adept at a keypad. And so I, in assembly, I built a keypad into the regular keyboard so I could type numbers in faster. You know, like if I'm typing every card in a Strat-O-Matic game set, I need to be able to type fast.
You ended up becoming an actuary, right? Yeah. After college, you mentioned being in an insurance company. Could you explain how your college experience of computer science and statistics ended up turning into this full-time job of being an actuary?
So, you know, I was a math major. I knew I was good at numbers. In college, you know, I took all the, you know, regular math classes, but I realized that as it became theoretical, like advanced calculus and doing proofs, that didn't interest me at all. I didn't care much about that at all. It was like, all right, math has ended for me. I got to do something that is more practical. And then I started learning about computer programming, which I loved. And I got a part-time job at an insurance company. It was simply a notice on the wall of the math department that said, math majors with a B average, we have a job for you. And so I interviewed, I looked up in a dictionary what an actuary was. I had no clue what an actuary was. And I remember this very well because the guy who interviewed me said to me, do you know what an actuary is? And I said, absolutely. It's blah, blah, blah. I had memorized the dictionary definition. And he was so impressed by that. I think just that one thing got me the job. But, you know, I did a lot of programming as an actuary, you know, and did a lot of analytical work of insurance numbers and profits and setting premiums for different types of insurance and setting reserves to set aside money to pay future claims. And so all that analytical work, which I actually really enjoyed doing, really paved the way for my analytical work in sports. I could never have dreamed other than the dream that I wanted to be the White Sox statistician, I never dreamed that there could be what eventually happened, that, you know, I could work full time as a sports actuary. But that's the next story.
Before we get to that story, and I guess being exposed to what we call sabermetric, was there anybody in sports, was it like a commentator or somebody you would read that really resonated with you statistically before you got introduced to the sabermetric community?
You mean before Bill or after Bill?
Yes, before Bill. So it's like, was it almost like a desert before that time, or were there other touch points that resonated with you?
I mean, the only other touch point I had that was not specific was the concept that I would love to be involved with the computerization of baseball data. I'm programming, you know, Strat-O-Matic baseball. I'm collecting data from the cards. But, you know, I always thought, you know, there should be a way to computerize and collect data in a much better way, or in a way. There hadn't been too many ways. I didn't know at that time that there was an Elias or the Pete Palmer company. He was doing the American League and Elias was doing the National League. And they had some, you know, they had computers and databases, but which I didn't know. I had the dream that someday we should computerize everything. And that was before Bill James. It was something that was in my mind. Not that I was doing anything about it, but it was in my mind.
So where'd you get that idea from? Was it just you could see the power of the technology and it was yet to be applied?
I love the technology. You know, I wrote all these programs. another example was, this will blow you away. So a friend of mine, a fellow actuary of mine, and actually three actuaries and a computer programmer got together and decided to type in the entire dictionary into an Apple computer. We typed every word into dictionary into an Apple computer because there was this contest where you construct crossword puzzles. You construct a crossword puzzle And every word, every letter had a value. And if you could construct a crossword puzzle with the highest value, you would win these wonderful prizes. So we decided, we're actuaries, we're smarter than the average bear. We're going to be able to create some computer programs to analyze the data from a dictionary. So every puzzle that you created would have different values. So one time the letter F would have a value of 26. So if you get as many Fs into the puzzle, and so we would have things like, all right, I need an F in the third spot of a five-letter word. Give me all that from the dictionary. And we'd run these, you know, all these different scenarios.
It's like a brute force algorithm type situation.
Yeah, it's just brute force. And we were certain we're going to win this thing. But we always decided it was this woman who was 45 years old and has nothing else to do but work on this full time. And we had to work full time. I don't know why we thought it was a woman, because we thought, well, two of our four members were women. So I think we just naturally thought women were smart. And it was always this woman who had unlimited time, was really smart, and somehow had all the time in the world to come up with the best crossword puzzle, because we couldn't believe anybody could beat us with our algorithms and our data. We typed in the whole dictionary. This had never happened before in the history of, I mean, there weren't dictionaries out there yet. You know, we could have monetized that all by itself. So anyways, this fascination with computers and applying them to solve problems, you know, occurred in everything that I was doing in my life, you know, whether it was the Stratomatic or crossword puzzles or my everyday work. You know, I just always thought there was more that could be done with that.
When you were at work, I guess a coworker exposed you to Bill James' writing. Could you tell that story?
It was Peter Crockett. So Peter Crockett hands me a copy of the Bill James abstract. I think it was 1982. And by this time it was, you know, part of the annual New York Times bestsellers list. He had some self-published versions prior to that, but he shared this with me and he said, you might enjoy this. And I'm like, oh, okay. So I pick it up and I start reading it and I'm like, oh my gosh, he is doing exactly what baseball data that I'm doing every day with insurance numbers. He's taking the numbers and finding insights in them and using them in different ways. And I was just completely fascinated with what he was doing. And then the year that he announced the Project Scoresheet project, I remember exactly what I was doing at the time and what I did next. And that was, I was sitting at the kitchen table reading about this Project Scoresheet of collecting and computerizing all the play-by-play data in baseball. And I remember, this is exactly what I want to do. This is what I've dreamed of, this database in sports. And I remember just sitting there staring off into space. What am I going to do? What can I do? I got to get involved. This is really cool. I love this. You know, And I really enjoyed my work as a insurance actuary. But so I just got up from the table and called directory assistance in Lawrence, Kansas for Bill James. And I got a phone number. And I called that phone number. I got a hold of Jim Baker, his assistant. And I was working on the project within a week. I started doing the programming for the collection software within probably a month. And then within a few months, I was the director of the project, you know, organizing people throughout the country to do the scoring and to use the input program to computerize everything.
So how did you end up so quickly just rising in the organization? Is there a story behind that?
Well, I mean, the organization had just started, and it was starting off slowly, but I think just my intention of brute force, I wanted this data. I would stop at nothing to make sure we got it. I would, you know, recruiting people throughout the country to do the work. We came out with a book called the Great American Baseball Stat Book. That was the main work. And you'll see all these names in that book. And all these people were people that just gravitated to what Bill was doing. And, you know, so, and I was the guy with the whip. All right, come on, we need those score sheets. All right, you got to get these games to us. You got to mail them on time. Come on, don't be late. And then, okay. And I had all my friends helping input the data. You know, I called my cousin Rich. Hey, Rich, where are you with those games you were inputting? Oh, yeah, I'll have them in a couple of days for you. Don't worry about it. We had our PC juniors. Everybody had a PC junior. We're inputting all the games. And so
were people doing this at home, like listening to the radio or watching TV, or were they in person?
So the scoring of the games was mostly off TV. But yeah, you could do it at the game or you could do it off radio. If worst comes to worst, do it off radio. And so you probably know my good friend Don Zminda, who worked for me for many years as a dedicated Sabre member. He had this incredible, elaborate taping system. So you'd have a cassette tape with tape recorders, but the cassettes only held 2 hours. So he would set up a series of tape recorders so that if the game went to like 4.5 hours, he would have 3 tape recorders set up to record the game, because he was a postman. He had to go out every day and do his postage runs or mailman runs. And then he, you know, his afternoon game, he'd have it all recorded. And then he just diligently scored everything. So he was like the White Sox guy. He would score every single game of the White Sox. And then I got him to leave his mailman career and come work for us at Stats. So it was a cool thing. We became friends. But yeah, it was like getting people to do all this work, but they mostly enjoyed it. So, you know, I say crack the whip, but it was mostly just coordinating. It wasn't really hard.
It sounds like you naturally became a coordinator because you were very motivated to get the data, like centralized.
Yeah. Yes.
You mentioned a book, but you've also mentioned computerizing the data. So what do you think were the overarching goals of the organization once they had that data?
To win Strat-O-Matic games. That was the overarching goal.
Was that your goal or the org?
No, that was my goal. It was, you know, I started doing that when I was 13 years old, and I still play Strat-O-Matic to this day, and I beat my son for the league championship 2 days ago. So that is my overarching concern for my life, is to win Strat-O-Matic games. You know, there's an element of truth to that, but it, you know, my fascination with baseball comes a lot from playing Strat-O-Matic games. My understanding of the game comes, you know, a lot from that. But, you know, the idea was to make a living from it. We love doing this. We love collecting it. How can we actually make a living out of it so that we can spend more time doing it? When I was the director of Project Scoresheet, I was approached by Dick Kramer, who was also a famous sabermetrician going back. And he had been working on a predecessor company, which was called Stats, but they basically had 2 team clients and then folded. He approached me and Bill about restarting the company, which we did out of a bedroom in my house. And we decided that instead of just having team clients, we would collect the data ourselves. So Project Scoresheet, we worked at Project Scoresheet from 8. When I say we, it was my wife and I doing a ton of the work. She left her full-time job before I did to do the programming work. We started working with Dick Kramer. He had some software that he brought to the table, and we decided we're going to collect the data in all for all the games, and computerizing using the software he had. So actually from 84, 86, I was director of Project Scoresheet. 87 was a joint project between Stats and Project Scoresheet. And then from 88 on, you know, we decided to run Stats as a full-time business. And my wife and I both left our jobs. We had our first employee living in the basement of our house, Carmen Carica. He would go from our basement up two flights into that bedroom. He would work for the day and then go back in. It sounds terrible, but it wasn't. It was really cool.
The decision to leave Project Scoresheet was essentially going to a company, right, that would have clients that are professional teams. So can you describe like what kind of clients you guys had at the time or were imagining that you would get, and what were sports teams doing with this information?
What we imagined that we would get was far different than what it turned out to be. You know, I remember creating a business plan for Stats that would have things like, all right, we're going to work with the game companies and we're going to provide, you know, information for games, and we're going to work with the teams and provide information for teams. And we'll do some work with the media. But the teams were not interested. You know, when we first started, we had two clients, the White Sox and the Yankees. And, you know, 5 years later, we probably had three team clients. I mean, it was, the teams just didn't get it at that point. And what we decided to do was try to work with the media. And the breakthrough was when we were talking to USA Today and they were like, can you guys do a custom box score for us? And we're like, absolutely. And how quickly after the game can you get it to us? You know, 3 minutes after the end of the game, you know, just to wrap everything up and, you know, modem, send it by phone modem to, and that was the breakthrough for us, because USA Today set us up with press passes so that we could have a person in the press box to record the information and then send by modem after the game. You know, prior to that, all box scores were done by someone sitting in the press box and calling it in and saying, Ricky Henderson, 4 at-bats, run, 1 hit, 1 RBI. And it just going right down the line, what a box score would look like. And it was just hand transcribed up until 1988, when we at Stats, with Dick Kramer doing the programming, created software that created the box score for USA Today. And then the next year we did it for the Associated Press. And it's been history ever since. It's how box scores are done ever since then.
So before USA Today approached you, could you describe the kind of data you were getting from, I guess, your network of everybody observing the games?
Absolutely. It was pitch by pitch data, not pitch type, but, you know, ball, strike, foul. And it was hit locations on the field. So when a ball was hit, we had these quadrants that would indicate where the ball was hit. And they were pretty detailed because it would go from like A to Z across the, you know, the diagonals emanating from home plate. Hit locations was a major thing, and pitch information was a major thing. So it became practice in the press box to turn to the guy that we had there to say, all right, what is Roger Clemens' pitch count at this point? And the guy would have it right on the computer. Oh, he's at, you know, 79 pitches. So that was one of the standard roles for the, you know, the Stats reporter in the press box at, you know, at that time. It may still be for that matter.
So at that time, were any of the radio or TV commentators kind of bringing up things like pitch counts, or did they have that information, or that wasn't available?
Our biggest breakthrough was the 1987 playoffs. We got together with somebody from the NBC team we had him come to St. Louis where our computer was stored. Our computer was in St. Louis in 1987 because it was stored at Dick Kramer's company where he was working in St. Louis. So I flew down to St. Louis from Chicago. He was there and the guy from NBC came by and we put up together all this information for them. So the playoff series starts and they're using something on almost every pitch and almost every, it was like overkill. It was like, wait a minute, you shouldn't use every little thing that we're providing. It's not all that interesting. A lot of it is. But that was our biggest breakthrough was in 1987. And one of the coolest stats is Danny Cox. So Danny Cox was a starting pitcher one day, and we had a stat that showed that pitches 1-70, opposing hitters hit, I don't remember the numbers, 216. And at 71 and beyond, they hit, 370. So he's coming up on 70 pitches, and Vince Scully announces this. And, be watching now because Danny Cox struggles as the pitch count gets deeper. So pitch 72 is like a line drive single to left. Pitch 74 is a double to right center. Pitch 77 is another double. And then like pitch 79 is a home run. And Vince Scully's just going nuts. He just is like, he's falling out of the booth. Just like, oh my gosh, this is the most incredible thing. Of course it's, there's a lot of luck involved that just so happened, the way things play out statistically, but
He liked it that it makes him sound
right
good too, right? I mean, it not only is it like a great to give fans that, but the fans don't know that in the background there's a computer program turning this out for them.
Right.
Did you guys decide, like you and Dick decide, like certain algorithms to run ahead of the game to calculate these things? Like it's almost like you're creating analytics before people are using them.
Right. Yeah. We knew we had incredible depth of data, all play by play, all situational. And, we could come up with things like that. So, he and I, and Bill James was involved with the company, but he wasn't involved with this project. Dick and I just said, okay, what would be interesting? Okay. We got data by pitch, by pitch count, we got lefty righty data that we can provide. We even provided like ground ball fly ball data at that time. We had temperature data. We actually provided temperature data that showed that when the temperatures were higher, there was more run scoring. So we had all kinds of data. It was almost like, okay, we could spend an infinite amount of time and, just getting all this data. What can we do to get them the quickest data in the, short amount of time? So that was an example of something we came up with.
So did you also come up with like the individual splits, like batter pitcher or this pitcher versus lefty righty? Were you also thinking about the world that way?
Absolutely. Yeah. Lefty righty, ground ball, fly ball tendencies. Splits by month and splits by count. That was a big one. Splits by count, because that had never seen the light of day to that point, because no one kept track of the count. And so we started sharing numbers that showed it's a big deal to be 2-0 rather than 0-2. It's a huge deal.
Probably had a hunch about, the platoon effect. I mean, in a general sense that it works or that 2-0 is good, but it sounds like from actually crunching the numbers for the first time, it looked like it was a bigger deal than people realized.
Yeah. I mean, some of the numbers were dramatic as to, how good it was to be 2-0 rather than 0-2. So that was stuff that saw the light of day for the first time, or this one example, Danny Cox and starting pitcher endurance, which pitchers had the endurance to go deep into a game. And as we know, as the game did develop from then on, it was like, well, pitchers started pitching less and less, starting pitchers starting pitching less and less, because it was clear that pitchers would, you know, become fatigued, and the numbers showed how fatigued they would get. And now there's the classic, you know, third time through the order is, you know, like the assumption is now that every pitcher will have difficulties in the third time through the order, which is generally true, but it's not universally true. So yeah, that kind of stemmed back to that. And we were learning that in the late 80s.
After that playoff series, did it end up spreading more in the broadcast world? Where
it did. It did. You know, I'm trying to think back to those days. Our, you know, our biggest contracts that we had at that time, or the biggest projects, they weren't all contracts. The biggest projects were the box score project. But then the guy who lived in our basement for a while, not very long, Carmen Carica, he played fantasy baseball. And so I think it was the late 87 season. He said, John, you got to play fantasy baseball. And I'm like, you know what? I'm too busy running a business on baseball than to play fantasy baseball, you know. But here I was playing Strat-O-Matic, so how different is that? But fantasy, you know what fantasy is. It's like playing, using players on your team as it's happening, rather than Strato, which is historical. But so he's like, well, manage this team with me. And he's showing me the reports that he's getting. And I'm like, this is fantastic. I love this. It was, and one of the coolest things was you really got to know the players. You really got to understand them. And you could look at the numbers and you could try to, you know, anticipate what they were going to do. And it was like, wait, anticipate what they're going to do. Why don't we project them? And Bill had these various systems to project a player. And I'm like, Bill, we got to come up with a once and for all system to project what players do. And he's like, no, I don't know. And I'm like, come on, Bill, you've already got the systems in place. You got this Brock 6 formula. Work with me. And then a few weeks later, he had an entire system built out on how to project hitters. And he didn't do pitchers at first. I wound up having to do the pitchers on my own. He didn't want to do the pitchers. But we had these great projection formulas. And so that was actually one of the products that came out, was another Bill James brainchild, which is now the Bill James Handbook. And the concept was, why do we have to wait till March to get our baseball data in a book form? Why don't we get it out sooner? And so we said, there's no reason we can't get this out by November 1st. So since 1990, this book has been coming out by November 1st every year, I think, except for one. So that was a Bill James brainchild. So that book, you know, was a huge thing in the public, in the baseball world, you know, having that data by November 1st. Now, of course, it's online, but back then you couldn't get that.
One of the reasons why you couldn't get it is because fans did not have access to the rich amount of data that you were collecting. What strikes me is that you mentioned earlier that you didn't see much growth in your professional team clients over time, but weren't people trying to connect the dots when they hear an announcer using your kind of analytics? Did you get a sense that teams were starting to get more interested in those splits numbers and...
You know, they were getting some of those basic splits numbers. You know, I know that Elias and Pete's company had been doing that. So that kind of stuff did exist. But what teams didn't realize is that there's so much more into it. So, at Stats, my special area of interest was defense. And that also stems back to Strato, because they had ratings of defensive ability of every player ranked from like 1 to 5. 1, you were a super elite defender. 2 was above average. 3 was average. 4 and 5 were, you know, bad. And I'm like, well, the numbers, there should be numbers that help you. And I just became fascinated with trying to use batted balls and velocity and direction and positioning of players. And that even started with Project Score Sheet data. 1986, here in Chicago at Loyola University, my alma mater, was a Sabre convention, first one I ever attended. And I did a presentation on Project Score Sheet data and how it can be utilized to better evaluate the defensive ability of players on the field. So things like, for example, if you had a highly predominant left-handed pitching staff, you would be facing a lot more right-handed batters, and those right-handed batters would pull the ball more often. And so your shortstop and third baseman are going to get a lot more attempts to make plays. And it will, with all the standard metrics that, well, the biggest metric was range factor at that time that Bill had invented like just a few years earlier. And it would make them look better than they really are, because they're getting, you know, more opportunities, making more plays. So I created an adjusted range factor that would take into account how, you know, the frequency of the batted balls, and especially the handedness of the pitcher affecting the way where the kind of hitters were at the plate. And it's then that I began to really realize how often players pull the ball, which later in my career turned into analyzing the shift and analyzing player tendencies. And my fascination with defense, which stemmed back to Stratomatic, has been what I've always been. I would always gravitate to analyzing that. You know, I would have some time from running the business. All right, we're going to start working on zone ratings, which was a stat that we invented at Stats. And so various defensive metrics have been my thing.
So it sounds like it wasn't for a team's consumption that you were necessarily inventing these analytics. It was more to grasp a better understanding of things like defense that were light on statistics at the time.
Yeah, it was, you know, we started doing publications and, you know, we wanted to share this with the world. We, you know, one of the phrases that always went through my mind that we would say out loud is we want to explode the world of baseball information. And so, you know, our mission was to share information with the public. It was things that we enjoyed, that we liked. We had all these publications before the internet came out, you know, the baseball player profiles and the all-time Major League Handbook. We were trying to get information out to the public. The teams weren't that interested. So we're like, well, let's get it out to the public. So, you know, my email address is still my AOL email address from the 90s, because we had a deal with AOL where we would do their sports site, baseball site on AOL. So they gave everybody at the company free email addresses, and we created this incredible site on AOL, you know, the first version of sports information, you know, in a highly accessible online community. So we had box scores and scoreboards that would update by the pitch, you know, you would barely be able to get that information overnight, or some of you wouldn't even normally get to that point overnight. Now we were updating in real time by the pitch.
So this was hosted on an AOL site, like AOL.com/something.
Yeah, it was. So you would be back then in the late 90s, you could subscribe to AOL for, I don't know, $19.95 a year. And we were the baseball sports site for them. So we would put the scoreboard and box scores, and we would put all of our statistical stuff up, you know, for people to utilize. So it was the first real internet sports site. And it was like maybe the most utilized site they had at AOL.
Was it purely numbers based, or was there a human element of writing?
It was numbers. It was just the numbers. We did our own writing. We had books that actually had writing in it. Don Zmindel was our main writer, and he was fantastic. But Bill wrote a lot for what we were doing, and But it was the numbers that we really focused on.
It sounds like it was a very successful partnership where you would get this data, you would come up with analytics, you would inform the public, whether it be online or in books. Then you got the partnership with USA Today and the Associated Press. What happened after those partnerships?
Let me just share one really big breakthrough, which was 1994. So we had been doing the box scores for USA Today and Associated Press for a few years. And we realized the way our software was set up and the way, you know, the fact that we were sending out data right after the game was over via a modem, that there's no reason we can't send out data earlier. We can send it out after every inning. We could send it out after every pitch. And so in 1994, and we didn't know there was going to be a strike that year, we decided we were going to invest, and we did invest a lot of money into creating real-time, the phrase was go live in all four sports. So we went live in all four sports. We started sending out our data after every point scored in basketball and every pitch in baseball and every play in football and every, I forget how we did it in hockey. It wasn't every play. But anyways, we were live in all four sports, and you could get in-progress box scores, as we called them, in every sport. And that was a huge, huge breakthrough. And then we almost went out of business because of the strike, but we hung in there.
Well, it's was it the computing hardware and I guess the lack of an internet that kind of constrained you earlier, and it was just the changing technology at the time that allowed you to do it at that time?
Yeah, we realized we had the technology to do it, and it was like, why isn't anybody else do it? We'll just do it. We're just going to do it. We're going to go live in every sport. And I remember bringing the concept to the Associated Press, right? We're already doing their box scores. And we're like, look, we could do box scores in the game. We can start providing this to your newspaper clients. We can, you know, we have a site. I don't know if we didn't have the site on AOL yet, but we had a vision for this. And they didn't get it at all. No, we wouldn't have any interest in that. Okay.
Certain people had a vision about what the future of the internet was.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we knew we had the technology. We didn't know exactly how it would get applied. We just knew it was cool. And it was a lot of, if we like it, other people are going to like it. We're incredible sports fans. I wanted to know what the score of a game was when it was happening, and not have, you know, if I was in a different location. So, you know, one of the coolest products we developed was called this Sports Tracks. With Motorola, it was a pager that would update as the game went on. So I remember very distinctly, I was at a friend's wedding, and I pulled out my pager, and I could keep track of what the White Sox were doing because it would update every play or so. I remember how often, but it would update regularly, and I could keep track of the game without like getting a radio or something. So it was very discreet. Just pull out my pager. Oh, okay, good. Whereas now that's what people do with their phones, right? Let's see the score of the game. Okay, I'll go back to the, you know, whatever else you're doing.
I mean, what's so remarkable, I think, about the story of that company was how it adapted to the technology with time very quickly. You could see where things were going, and you kept working hard, reinventing products, putting out new things. I mean, as a programmer, that's a very difficult thing to do, to constantly update your technology. And it sounds like you were driven because you could see the promise for fans and yourself. It excited you.
Yes. I think that hits it on the head. It was, we wanted it for ourselves, and we believed that others would want it too. And we, you know, one thing that I realized as I go back, look back, we were really good programmers. We were really good. We could turn things around so quickly because we, you know, knew how to, our databases were structured, and, you know, being able to set up the software, you know, to send out data in real time because of how it was structured, and we knew it, we could do it quickly. Or Bill invented James Fantasy Baseball. That was another product that we had. And he gave us all the rules. He did everything. And then in 2 months, we programmed the whole thing to run as an online game. It was online in 2 months. And people loved the game. And it was like you could play, you know, you could play on the internet. There was no internet. You could log into the Stats online system and you could look at your, you know, how your team is doing, and you can make transactions and look at how each player is doing and so on. So it was pretty cool. And we were such good programmers, we could do it quickly without realizing what an accomplishment we had accomplished. We were just doing it because we could.
How did you end up riding the ship after the baseball strike?
Well, you know, it was a really tough time at the company, and our mission was not to lay anybody off. We were losing money, but we did things like we let people take time off without pay, and we let them buy stock into the company to generate some cash. We did everything to, you know, it was very important to us not to lay off anybody. And we were able to accomplish that. And then, you know, once the strike was over, then we could resume our normal business and keep doing the things that but in 1995, they started the season with replacement players. So, you know, strike breakers, people who wanted to play baseball, never had a chance, but they could play now because the regular players weren't going to play. And we actually created the replacement player handbook so that people could learn about these players, you know, before they took the field. And it was pretty cool. We tried to do everything to keep our business going. that's a rare collectible these days, the replacement player handbook.
You know, looking back, I don't know how many fans would be very thrilled to get their hands on that.
Well, we wanted it. And then probably 14 other people did too.
Your company ended up getting more investment capital, right?
And right. So what was happening was people saw we were doing some pretty cool things, and we started getting approached. We kept getting approached. People wanted to buy into us. I wasn't too keen on selling personally because I just enjoyed the work. But other people really wanted to, you know, cash in. And, you know, so we created a process where we hired an investment banking firm, and they went out and got bids, you know, on the company. Bids is not quite, you know, look for interested party that then turned into various offers for the company. And it was an incredible process that played out. It was the exact right time. It was, you know, the late 90s there was a huge internet buzz and technology company buzz, and it hit at the exact right time. And then I got a call from James Murdoch, the son of Rupert Murdoch. I remember it very well. It was Thanksgiving weekend, and he called me on Saturday and he said, "What would it take to sell the company?" And I'm like, "Well, I got this other offer, but it's not cash. If you could come up close to it in cash, it's a done deal." And then he did. On Monday, I got the offer. And I feel blessed that I could take a career that all I was looking to do was make a living and, you know, do something that very few people in this world have a chance to do. But I have to admit, I loved those days when we were like 50 to 75 employees or 25 to even 25 to 50 employees. Wound up going back to it when I was approached by Steve Moyer, who worked with me at Stats, and he said, John, let's go even deeper. Let's collect pitch type and location. You know, was it a fastball? Was it a curveball? Was it, you know, 1 inch off the outside corner at the knees? And I'm like, yeah, I think that's a great idea. Let's do that together. So we decided to go deeper in baseball, and that's how the second company started, Baseball Info Solutions and Sports Info Solutions.
Well, I feel like you have so many interesting stories. I mean, I think you skipped, didn't you get a capital infusion from Paul Allen?
Oh, yeah. That reminds me, because I talked about the strike and that money came in at that time. So that is what got us through the strike. So I remember it was an $800,000 investment and we lost $800,000 in 1994. So it really helped us.
So how did you convince the co-founder of Microsoft and convince him to fund you guys?
Well, the funding came in before the strike, so no one knew about the strike was coming. And I don't remember the exact timing, but I think that's what really helped in getting us through, along with these other things that we did. And, you know, they approached us. You know, we weren't like looking to get investment, but they heard about us and they were starting a company called Starwave, which was the company programming ESPN.com. It became ESPN.com. And they saw the content that we had and they were like, oh, that'd be good content for the site. And they offered us an investment for 20% of the company. And we said, okay. Then a couple of years later, the offer from ESPN came through and they really wanted us to take that offer because they were going to be doing the website and, you know, they had ownership in our company. It got into a little battle. I was actually in battle with Paul Allen, co-founder of Microsoft. So that was a challenge there to fend off Paul Allen. We worked it all out. We bought his stock back actually